Welcome to Bounce Back. My name's Yvonne Fletcher from NY Events and you're listening in on DRN1. Bounce Back is a fun talk back show. And today we have Jez Watts. How are you going, Jez?
Hey, hey. I'm just excited to talk to another human being. I'm in Melbourne for your listeners. And so it's been 7 months of lockdown. It's just lifted, but I've got to like ease back into human interaction. So this is a nice little stepping stone.
Oh, it's so good to have you. And I'm sorry you've been in lockdown for 7 months. How did you cope?
It was real bad for a while, like the first couple of months, because it's like, this is true for stand-ups all over the world, but like it felt like when COVID hit, like our entire industry evaporated.
Yeah.
So the first like month or two was brutal. But then like things like, because we're lucky to be in Australia, like because JobKeeper has come in. So like I've been fine for money. But it's just, yeah, it's a huge part of your life that's just not there. Mm. So it's been a strange adjustment.
I get what you're saying about we've been okay money-wise until JobKeeper, you know, kind of stops. But
no, wait, that's not going to happen. What? I'm not thinking about that yet. That's okay.
Mentally,
if I was in the States, like, I mean, there's no support. I think they got like $1,000 once. Yeah, and then, like, that's it.
Yeah,
so
it has been really hard on the arts industry, that's for sure. But mentally, how have you coped with that? Because I'm a real people person. I struggled with the little lockdown that we had here, and I have really felt sorry for you guys in Melbourne.
How long were you guys locked down for?
Very shortly, and it wasn't even a full lockdown. We were still able to go walking and still able to, you know, get takeaway. I think it was March until about May. So.
Oh man, that feels like the dream. So I mean, I'm not like a super social person anyway. Like, I'm definitely like somewhere on the spectrum. And initially, I was like, oh man, who cares? Like, lockdown's gonna be fun. I'm gonna play a bunch of video games. And I do like live with my fiance, so it's like I'm not like completely isolated. But it turns out, like, actually, you need some kind of human interaction. Like, it was. Oh man, it was a long. The last 7 months has felt like an eternity. It's been forever. But like a couple of months ago, because I was like in a sort of a real bad place, my partner Nicole, she sort of pushed me to go to therapy, which we've been talking about. I definitely need therapy. I've needed therapy for a long time, but it's like a hard thing to do. So I was like avoiding it for a long time, and I was like, "Oh, I got to go tour, so you know I can't get into heavy stuff about my childhood or whatever." But like I went and started, like we did some couples therapy for a couple sessions, and then like I got my own therapist, and that has been great. Like, so now I'm actually doing really well. Like, yeah. I'm not like back to pre-pandemic levels of, you know, life satisfaction or whatever, but. I'm doing like a lot healthier. Oh man, therapy is sick.
Great.
I love it.
I actually think that everyone should invest in therapy.
It's so good.
Yeah,
I feel bad for my therapist. Like he's bitten off a big meal in me, but like he was very excited the first session because I like you know you get to know each other or whatever. And I was like, oh, yeah, I'm a comedian. And he was like, ooh, a comedian. I've never had a comedian before. He looks, like, so excited. And, like, now it's like Nicole came up with this line, but, like, if you look at him, like, before and after the therapy session, it looks like Obama before and after the presidency, like, where, like, he's, like, young and full of hope, like, at the beginning of the 50 minutes, and by the end it's just, like, all the colour is bleached from his hair. It's just, like, it's a hard thing for him. But he's, like, good dude. He's hanging in there. Well done to him.
I actually reinvested in therapy myself out of COVID because I thought, well, I think it's time that I own some of my, you know, fears of getting into a relationship. So I thought, okay, time to invest in that. Seen a therapist for about three times it was, and, you know, I'll go back to her again because I do think it's really important to touch base with someone. And, you know, my last session with her was, you know, Yvonne, I actually think you're a pretty well-rounded person and maybe you need to go a little bit easier on yourself.
Well, I can't wait to get to that session with my guy. Where he's like, yeah, I think you're doing all right. I think the session last week, I think we've had like maybe 6-7 sessions so far. Mm. And there's going to be a lot more. Last week I think was the longest. It was sort of the record, where like I went like 40 minutes before he went, like, oh, that's really sad. But yeah, like there's like if every like little rock we pull up, it's like, oh, there's a whole new mess of like dysfunction here that we've got to like now start addressing.
Yeah.
But no, it's good. It's like it's a very healthy thing to do. Even though it's not like easy.
Yeah.
But yeah, he called me out for a great thing actually last week where he went, you know, like you say something that's just like really sad and then you laugh. And I was like, yeah, that's my style. Like that's, that's like how I do jokes.
Oh, hey Jez, how old are you as well?
What's that?
How old are you?
Oh, I turned 37. During lockdown.
Okay. Well, happy birthday.
Yeah. Which, yeah, like it's because I started stand up late. Like I started at 29. So I've been doing it like 8 years.
Yeah.
And like for the first 2 or 3 years, like I still looked like 22. And so it was normal, you know, like that I was like just starting out. And then I suddenly aged like 5, 6 years, like overnight. I think like when I started doing festival shows, it was just like so much stress of like trying to, manage promotion and like touring and stuff that I just immediately became, you know, 37. Now I'm still 37 now. Yeah. But 37.
Yeah, I think I mean, I know you don't actually have children, do you? So
no, I have bunny rabbits. Yeah, and that they're our children. Yeah.
Well, for myself, I think that something happens when I turned 40 and I started to really invest in looking at childhood stuff and things that had impacted me today as an adult. And maybe that's what you're going through a little bit of, you know, your journey of therapy as well. And I think when you unravel that stuff, it's actually really, it's so good for you, isn't it? And
it's really interesting. Like there's so much, there's so many like behavioral quirks or whatever that you don't necessarily consciously as a human being, as an adult, like realize has been sort of programmed into you early, you know, like if you, especially if you have, you know, like trauma or, you know, like just like bad stuff in your childhood or just, you know, things you didn't handle well or that were bad sort of events, like that ends up going really deep rooted into like how you react to just regular things. And that's been really interesting. You like it to sort of unpack. And then once you have it there to look at, you can be a bit more conscious about, you know, how you're acting and why you're acting certain ways, you know. Like, it's been really helpful for Nicole and I. Like we had a good relationship already, but then like during the first maybe 3 or 4 months of this lockdown, like because I was in like such a depressive state, like we definitely had like the most tension I think we've had in the relationship. And then so because we started out with those couple sessions, it really helped us to like get a good look at each other and ourselves, and it's really helped the relationship. But it's crazy. Like I forget who said the line, but it was like that we are as people like the sum of our parents' mistakes.
Yeah.
But it's like all that little stuff like that really doesn't seem consequential. It all like goes into shapes who you are.
Mm.
So it's been interesting.
My actual parenting philosophy is that our parents did the very best that they knew how to do. And we can improve on that. And I like that. I like that, you know, even my kids are going to have issues. You know, I'm a perfect mum. I'm joking. I make heaps.
Yeah, no, you seem great. As far as I know, you're good.
No. I try my best. And I think that's the thing when you are, everyone tries their best. And, you know, there is times where it's just going to, we're all going to walk away with shit. That's just being honest.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And also like the least interesting people I've ever met are the ones that are like the most healthy. It's like, I don't want to have a conversation with you, man. Like you got nothing to say. Like I kind of like, I mean, certainly as a comic, like everyone I know is like super messed up. And I think that's part of like what makes them interesting people. But it's also like, you just got to like find the stuff that's really destructive and like sort of sand off those edges and be like, okay, maybe I shouldn't do this and that. But it's good to be a little messed up, I reckon.
Oh, I think so. You know, you've got to find your kind of crazy, don't you? Hey, and well done on you and Nicole getting through 7 months of lockdown and investing in each other.
If she didn't leave me after this, like she ain't leaving, which is pretty cool.
you better marry that girl fast, okay?
Yeah. We're supposed to be getting married next year. In September, hopefully. But like it depends how vaccines and all that kind of stuff comes.
Yeah, will you get married in Melbourne or will you come back to Perth for that?
I think, yeah, like we're looking, there's a, because she's a veterinarian, right? So she loves animals. So we are looking at, there's an animal sanctuary called Hillsville Sanctuary. It's like an hour or two outside of Melbourne, which is like a beautiful, beautiful place. And so they do weddings. So like we want to like do it there.
That sounds amazing.
And then I want to get her like a thing where you swim with platypuses like for like maybe the morning.
Yeah.
Or like the day before. So then even if the wedding's a bust, like she swam with a platypus. So she'll always remember that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we want to do it there. Yeah. We'll see how it goes.
Yeah. Very special. I do have some questions for you. So, you know, you mentioned it was 8 years that you've been a comedian.
Yeah. I think like coming up on 8 years now.
Yeah. What made you want to become a comedian then?
Well, this year doesn't count so much though. I think I always wanted, I love stand up from like, I think I was maybe 16 or 17 when I saw like Eddie Murphy's Delirious and Raw.
Yeah.
And I don't think I had really seen proper stand-up before that. And I don't know if that was something that was just lacking for the people around me or if it, I don't think it was as big an art form in Australia at the time. But then like having seen that, I fell in love with it. And my friends and I, like we would just starting to experiment with smoking weed. So we would like hang out and we would smoke weed and then we would watch like arguably like one of the funniest specials there's ever made. There's now some very problematic stuff in it, which if like, if you're going to watch Eddie Murphy Delirious, maybe skip the first 5 minutes. There's some really, there's some bad points of view in there, but like, it's still very funny.
Chasing the ice cream truck, right?
Oh yeah. The ice cream bit's great. but yeah, so I fell in love with that and my friends and I, like we would memorize like passages from it. And then we'd tell each other those bits. And then like I got into other stand up and I really wanted to do it definitely, but I didn't, I've got like huge self-esteem issues. My therapist tells me, I definitely didn't feel like it was something I could do, but I just loved it. Yeah. And then it took me, let's say that I fell in love with stand up at 17 and then it took me till I was like 28 or 27, something like that. I was like in the States and I was in New York for a few months and I met like an open micer in New York and like for me, I was like, oh, comedians, they're like the special, like top level guys and girls. Yeah. But I sort of didn't have a perception of there were people who started out.
Yeah.
I just was like, you're a pro comedian or you're not a comedian. And then those people are only special people. And then I like met an open micer and like, I was like, oh, and like, she was funny, but like, I was like, oh man, she's just a person. Like people can do this.
Yeah.
So then I immediately was like, oh, I'm going to like, started like writing a set list and stuff. And I thought before I stepped on stage, like when I got back to Australia is when I did my first set. But like, I thought before I got on stage, I had like a list of kind of stories, like just funny stories I would tell girls, in order to get laid. Like, no, they maybe look good, but just, like, I would entertain someone until at some point, like, we were both naked, and then, like, I could have sex with them. That was, like, my whole thing. I'm not a big guy. I'm a masculine guy, but I could be funny enough to have sex. And so I was just, I wrote this list of stories. It was, like, an hour worth of stories, and I was like, yeah, I have my first hour. Like, I had no conception of the fact that this stuff wasn't going to necessarily work on stage or work in the same way, and I really thought I had like my first special before I'd ever got on stage. And then like I did a set and it went fine, but yeah, there's a big learning curve. Like that stuff's not gonna fly, you know? Like that 20-minute story you tell is probably 4 good jokes when you really break them down.
Okay. I'm going to take you back to Delirious, actually. It's something that I loved in high school as well. What was your favorite line?
I don't know. I mean,
I can share mine if you like.
Nothing of the first 5 minutes, of course. Yeah, I don't know. There was like a lot of really amazing stuff in it. I mean, yeah, you mentioned the ice cream bit, like that big story. Yeah. Like the great thing about Eddie Murphy's stand-up, and he's coming back, which is cool. But the great thing about it, or the very special thing about it, was he was amazing at these big long act outs and these big long stories and like sort of embodying those characters. And yeah, like that ice cream bit, I think is the really iconic thing. where the stuff with, oh man, the stuff with his dad, like drunk and yelling at Uncle Gus.
Yeah.
It's like, Gus, why you bring a Bigfoot to my house? And like, and that is, that's not funny the way I said it, but like, it's very good. Like, he really captured, I think, his drunk dad beautifully. Like, I think that, yeah, that stuff, yeah. The Uni Goo Goo, oh, that whole section, yeah, is amazing.
And the G.I. Joe goes swimming in the water, you know, that part.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. No, there's a lot of good stuff. I'm going to rewatch that, actually.
I know, me too. I always theme that part, the G.I. Joe part, with, I mean, the Jaws, the music, like in my head. And just, yeah, I don't know, do warp things. What do you express? What does your comedy basically aim to express? Sorry, do you have something that you're aiming for, or besides picking up girls to sleep with them?
yeah, well, that's not the case anymore. No, because I started dating Nicole like the week I did my first gig. So like the whole concept behind me being funny, which 100% was only, you know, to have sex with people, really has, yeah, no use anymore. but you, yeah, I don't know successful. That I'm aiming to be funny. That seems like a really stupid answer, but like, I mean, I'm aiming to be funny and truthful, I suppose. I don't think I have an aim necessarily, other than I want to say true stuff that's funny. Mm. Like, that's always been something I've sort of, it's maybe held me back in some ways, in that, like, if I can think of a funnier version of a joke or a story or a twist or a turn in something, but it's less true, like I have a hard time just picking the funnier thing. That's actually been something that I've learned a lot in the last maybe three or four years. I've become less precious about how true stuff has to be.
Yeah.
And that's definitely made me a lot funnier. Mm. But yeah, that's sort of where I start. That was the starting point.
Is that like fabricating the truth a little bit, or embellishing the truth, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. I think I heighten stuff more, it's still emotionally true, if that makes sense. Like, mm. The stories are still fundamentally, there's a structure to it that is true. But now it's like I'm more comfortable, you know, heightening details, adding details, changing elements, because it will just make it a funnier piece.
Definitely
for my first couple of years particularly, like I was way too beholden to them being true. But I don't think I have like a goal of the stuff. I mean, I don't want it to reinforce bad ideas, I suppose. You know, I don't want it to be evil.
Yeah.
But I don't have a goal beyond that. I want to be funny.
Yeah. What's been your biggest learning curve then?
Hmm?
What's been your biggest learning curve in comedy?
I don't know. I think I've had a lot of them. There's a lot of things that didn't come naturally to me. And like, actually, this is part of the reason I'm doing like a lot of therapy now. And this is why I've been talking about doing therapy for a long time, which is that I have a really hard time properly opening up about like my, like how I feel about stuff. And I think, like, there's been a lot of stuff I've had to learn and a lot of stuff that's been hard to adjust to. Like, I came from science, like before comedy. Like, I used to be like a research scientist. And one of actually the specific, like, hardest things I had to get out of the habit of that still plagues me now is in science, like, when you're writing a paper, the whole thing is to like lay out all the pieces of information so the audience gets to the conclusion before you do. Mm-hmm. So that when you say the conclusion, that is now a proven statement.
Yeah.
And that is sort of the opposite thing in stand-up, where like comedy, like a joke, it's just a bunch of words with a surprise ending, you know, like that's fundamentally what a joke is. And so if you front load all the stuff so the audience gets there before you, it's like, literally, you've sucked the funny out of that idea.
Yeah, someone's going to shout out, aren't they?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, absolutely. But even if they don't yell it out, it's like if they got there already. So it's like, yeah, that's still something that I have a problem with today, where always the first draft of something will be like way too long-winded at the beginning. And at least I know enough from like, you know, last 8 years or whatever, where now I'm like, okay, I write it out and then I'm, or I talk it out or whatever. I'm like, okay, cool. So that first 30%, just cut it. Like it's unnecessary completely.
Okay.
Yeah, that I think has been maybe the biggest like single thing that's been hard to sort of adjust to, I suppose. Yeah, maybe.
Yeah. That's interesting. All right. So what was the biggest bomb you've ever had?
Well, there's a lot of them. I think maybe the biggest, yeah, all right, this is maybe the biggest bomb. I'm not going to tell you this joke. I won't tell you the joke that I said, but I'll tell you what the joke was about. So this is this is maybe the second gig I had, the third gig I'd ever had. So there's a competition in Australia called Raw. Not Raw. Is it Raw? Yeah, Triple J's Raw. Yeah. Competition. It's like a national competition for stand-up. For like newer people is the idea, but it's generally people who've been in for a few years who will, you know, get to the final in Melbourne. So it was my second gig and somebody mentioned that Raw, like I could sign up to do Raw. And at the time, I didn't know enough to know that I shouldn't be trying to get in front of like major bookers and you know, trying to make something of myself. Like you need to learn how to do stand-up first. So I did, like, at the time I was listening to a lot of Ari Shafir and Anthony Jeselnik, both of whom are very dirty and very offensive comedians who are both very accomplished at doing those things. But I was a new stand-up. And so I, like, was brand new. And I would get on stage and say things. Like, the first gig, I didn't really do that. The second gig, I think I already had some stuff that was really like beyond the pale, like just very offensive and not funny, which is a real problem to put those two things together. So I signed up for Raw to like get a spot, like just to do 5 minutes. And I did it at the Comedy Lounge, where I think you guys are now promoting gigs. But at the time it was John McAllister who runs like the proper comedy club that there is in Perth. So he did that at the Charles Hotel. So I did my Raw spot, which is my third ever spot, and top to bottom, this 5 minutes was just oof. It was it was meanly unfunny. It was like the intent was to build irony into it.
Yeah.
Where I was saying like horrific stuff, but sort of as a character, but not really understanding how that works. You know, the reason Anthony Jeselnik works as a comedian is like he's playing a character on stage that is this very mean, offensive, unfeeling guy, and the audience understands that that's a character, right? That's why that works. He can say like horrific stuff. I didn't get that. You know, I was just like, yeah, you say horrific stuff and then people laugh. Well, that must be how comedy works. So before I went up, Mike Goldstein, who's a great comic, he was emceeing and he was like, hey man, like you want me to say anything in particular to the crowd? And I was like, yeah, could you just tell him this next guy's real dark and just like a complete tool, all right? And he looked at me, he didn't say anything about me, like, all right. So he went out and it's this next comedian is very dark. And then yeah, give it up for Jez Watts, all right? And then I walked out and I did a bunch of very offensive jokes, and I closed with something that, again, I'm not going to tell what the joke is, but in the set list, it was written as Indian rape joke. It was a very, very bad thing. Especially, I mean, I would never even do it now. There is a funny idea in it, but it is not worth doing. It is very, very bad.
Yeah.
And so I did this thing. I bombed. Like the crowd was very unhappy to see me at all. And then I walked off to silence, I'm sure. Mike G came back out and he said, give it up for that miniature Goebbels. as I walked backstage, John McAllister, the promoter, like walked by me and he said, so I could hear, but not to me. But he just said, as he walked by me, what the fuck was that? And like, I think he still remembers it, to be honest. Like we've never really had a great relationship from like booker comedian. And like, I think it was just the worst first impression I could have made on both of them. Oh, no. Yeah, no, that was a bad one. But I've had a lot of bombs.
yeah. I think you grow but from bombs and yeah. Yes. Yeah, just to clarify, no, the Comedy Lounge is still the Comedy Lounge and we are doing the Charles Hotel. That's due to a relationship that Nicole has with Chris, the owner there. So they're
Macedonian. Oh yeah, I mean that's the thing. They moved to like a custom venue anyway.
Yeah, custom venue. And they're still raw and all that. So it's an amazing venue, the Comedy Lounge. It's just as you said, it's purpose built, it's incredible.
Mm. Yeah, because like, that really is like John McAllister's like labor of love. Like for years he was sort of dreaming of doing this. And for like while he was in the design phases, I know he was getting calls from comedians from all around the world who were like, if they would go to a good club, they would like literally call him up and be like, hey, it has this detail or like this element or like this is the height you want the stage and like, oh man, you need to make sure like there's like a toilet in the green room or like whatever. Like, so like it really is a beautiful, beautiful venue.
It's incredible.
But yeah, there was a lot of great shows at the Charles and a lot of bad ones too, but that's true of any venue.
They're all good now, okay?
No, now it's all perfect. It's all amazing. Go to the Charles.
Who are your biggest influencers? Maybe not just comedy-wise. It could be life-wise as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think I definitely – I mentioned before, but this is a comedy thing, but like I mentioned before, but Ari Shaffir has been a massive influence on me stylistically and also sort of career-wise as well. Like because he did like our showcase when we were in Edinburgh. My best buddy, Glenn Grimwood, very funny comedian, still in Perth. Yeah. He was saying to me afterwards, he was like, yeah, cause I was hosting the show and then Ari came on and like did the first set of like of the Nasty Show. And, Glenn afterwards, when we were like having a beer talking about it, was like, man, I knew you were influenced by him, but watching you guys back to back, like you could just see all the DNA of that whole comedy style. And I think that's because like I was like super into his podcast and also his comedy and the subject matter and everything. So I sort of absorbed everything. And those first couple of years, particularly in stand-up, I think, you know, whoever you're really listening to a lot, like that ends up becoming a big part of your persona, I suppose. So there's a massive stylistic influence there, but I mean there's a lot of different comics that I'm interested in and have absorbed things from, like consciously and unconsciously. Influences in life, actually maybe Glenn is actually a big influence. He's because we started comedy at the same time and we're very close, but it's he's still in Perth now and I'm here, and at the time that I moved, he was very envious. He was like, oh man, you get to go to Melbourne, we get to do comedy all the time. And now the tables have turned. he's actually been a wonderful I would say like almost a moral center to me. Mm. Like there are many times over the years where it's like, I'm maybe not sure how to handle something, or I'm not sure what the right way to approach some problem in life or comedy or whatever it is. And Glenn always has like a great just sort of sense of right. And not even necessarily only right and wrong, like morality wise, but like he just really sees to the core of stuff. He's been a huge influence on me.
Yeah.
And I've missed the shit out of him. Actually, can I say shit? I don't know.
Yeah.
But yeah, I've like missed him so much. Like, it's been weird. Like, cause I always have been someone who, you know, has like a sort of a few good friends, not necessarily a lot of people I'm close to. And, the move to Melbourne, cause he was initially supposed to move with myself and Nicole, like we're all three of us going to move here and then we're going to like share a house. And then he like fell in love with someone and they like own a house in Perth. So then he ended up deciding to stay there to see how that relationship was going to go, which I very much urged him to do. I was like, no, you have to, you can't like run away from love. You know, it's crazy. To not have that sort of because we even work together, like we worked at IKEA together in our day jobs. So to not have that like everyday interaction with someone who's like so much a sounding board, it was really hard. It's probably the hardest part of the move.
I'm thinking, yeah. Jez, IKEA in Perth must be the best place to work because so many of you comedians it's work not. There.
It's bad. When I started, it was actually not bad. It was all right. It was all right. It was pretty good. But when I started, because we worked, it was myself and Glenn, and there were like, I think maybe three other Perth comedians, which is, there's only like 12 comics in Perth or whatever, you know, like, so it's like, that's a big proportion. But when I started, like, you could listen to podcasts really loud while you were restacking the shelves. And I think you started at maybe 4 or 5 a.m., which is like not late. It's not like a good time to go to work after you've been at a gig till midnight, but it's a lot better than they start now at like 3 a.m. Mm-hmm. And you can't listen to music. You can't listen to podcasts. It's like, it honestly feels like more of a sweatshoppy environment. From like the reports I'm getting back. Like, Glenn is not happy. I mean, if anyone's listening that knows Glenn, he loves his job and please don't fire him, but it's brutal. Apparently. Yeah. I really was happy because it was early this year, maybe last year, I sort of went like full time in comedy, where I didn't have like a day job anymore. And I was like so happy to not have to like wake up for a 3 a.m. shift. Mm. Oh man, that is not fun.
No, I can, I feel for everyone on weekend, but it's 3 a.m. Oh, yeah, no, not my style. I'm not a morning person. So,
yeah, I had multiple times the police would like stop me on my way to work thinking I was coming home late.
Yeah.
Drunk, you know, and I would like be wearing my IKEA stuff. Like, dude, I have had 3 hours sleep, like, or 2 hours sleep. Like, I haven't had anything to drink. Can you please just let me go to work before I kill myself? Like, it was, oh my God. It was, yeah, that was hard.
Hey, Jez, also, what is your creative process like then? Do you write things out or how do you rehearse? What do you do to get your jokes out?
I mean, there's a lot of different stuff, and I think it evolves over time. So what I do now maybe is not what I'm going to do in 2 years, and it certainly wasn't what I did 2 years ago. Mm. But I have I sort of have maybe three or four different approaches, like that all sort of complementarily work. A big thing for me is I need deadlines to work. That's always been true even before I got into comedy, is that if I didn't have a deadline, I just wouldn't get anything done. So the last 7 months, like, because initially I wasn't doing Zoom shows because I was like, ugh, Zoom, that's not stand-up. And not having gigs to do meant I just wasn't writing. But like I, now that I'm doing Zoom shows and also like stand-up is sort of seeming to almost maybe return soon here in Melbourne at least, is like it's much easier for me to write. But I'll have notes on my phone.
Yeah.
And then I also have whiteboards on, like I have a room in the house that's dedicated, that's dedicated to stand up. So when I go into that room, that's to work. And so I have whiteboards on the wall with like premises and notes. And then also I'll have like cork boards where like I can, you know, plan out show structures and so on for like festivals. And then I also have physical notebooks. Like when I first started, I used to type everything out in like just a word processor and then I would print it out and it would all be word for word with pauses and everything. And I would print that out and I'd bring the A4 sheets of paper to gigs and I'd be walking around backstage just trying to memorize this like monologue.
Yeah.
Which is not what stand-up is, you know? Like it's not a monologue. It's a dialogue with the audience. So like that's... It's, I think a lot of people have like that kind of thing at the beginning where they're trying to like memorize stuff by rote, which is not it's not a way to really do stand up, but I think it's an easier concept to approach than genuinely getting up there and, you know, like listening to the crowd and responding in kind.
Yeah.
It's a much scarier thing to do.
Yeah.
Because what if they don't like me? And like that, once that happens a few times, you're like, oh, it's fine. You know, like it's a bad night. And then, it's the next gig is fun.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I think I do all that stuff and I still, sometimes I'll write things out long form, but I don't try to memorize them anymore.
Mm.
But like I'll maybe walk around talking about it and I will write out long form, the full ideas or notes But then by the time I get to the gig, it's like two words. It's Indian rape joke. You know, I'll have that written down. not anymore. But I'll have like a couple of words, you know, like this is cheese porn. This is walkouts or whatever. And then, you know, that'll be a minute or 2 minutes or however long that bit is. Mm. But then also there's a huge iterative process where some comics, and Glenn is one of these, some comics somehow, I don't know how, just have an internal barometer of how stuff is going to look by the end of it.
Yeah.
And they get on stage and that's great.
Yeah.
And it might get refined and they might find new punchlines here and there. But by and large, like they've got most of the idea and most of the wording right. Like maybe it's 75% done before they get to the doing it at an open mic. That is not the way I do it. And I wish it was. It would be great. but my stuff is generally, you know, like it's maybe 25% of the way there, like by the first time I get it in front of people.
Yeah.
And then there'll be loads of things that I was so sure were funny. Often it's the thing I'm most sure is the funniest part of it gets nothing. And then maybe something that I just thought was something on the way to something funny. Maybe that's the funniest part of it. Like that's happened loads of times. So I really like need that audience reaction like over multiple iterative sets to like refine an idea and get it to where it needs to be. So it might take me 20 times. Like sometimes something will come out and it'll just be good. But like in general, I think it probably takes 10, 15, 20 times of performing a particular idea or a joke till it sort of recognizably gets to where it's going to finally be.
Okay.
Yeah. And then some stuff takes longer and sometimes it takes shorter.
Yeah. You started Infinite Jest as well.
Yes. Long dead now.
Oh, is it really?
Well, I mean, yeah, I think I have hosted trivia under the title, but that's where comedy goes to die for sure. So that was like just for any listeners, that was a weekly show I ran at the Flying Scotsman, which I think even that doesn't exist. Is that right? It got taken over by other people or shut down?
Yep.
Yeah, but it was like a weekly show I ran for like 4 or 5 years. Yeah, that was a lot of fun.
It was good. And you used to do 51st jokes as well. I know that you were going to do that again this year and then COVID wiped that out. So
Because obviously now I live in Melbourne, but like the idea in my head now is that anytime I come back to Perth, like I'll do another 51st jokes, which just, for anyone who doesn't know, it's like the idea is that any comedian who wants to get up. So initially the idea was to get 50 comics and then like cap it at that, but instead it's become anyone. So I think the most we've had is like maybe 47 or something on it, because it's Perth. It's a smaller place.
Yeah.
But yeah, everyone can come up, everyone can get up and do material, but then it gets a limited amount of time and it all has to be brand new. Like they kind of tried it anywhere. So it's, there are a lot of ups and downs in a night like that.
I can imagine.
that was loads of fun. If anything, that's maybe the thing I most miss from Perth is like every 3 months I would do that show. And that's such a fun show to do. And I think it only, because I had multiple people like from Perth are like, oh, you're going to do 51st jokes in Melbourne. And it's like, it actually wouldn't fit the scene here in the same way it did in Perth. Like partly the scene's too big and partly there's already new material rooms. And I don't know, there's something special about the size of the scene and, you know, what Perth is and what Perth comedy is that like that just was the right, I think it was like the right idea at the right time or whatever.
Yeah. No, yeah, it is actually really good. How long did you run that one for then?
51st Jokes or Infinite Jest?
Oh, 51st Jokes.
I think it's probably, I've been doing comedy like 8 years. It's probably about a four-year-old idea as a show. Or that being said, I didn't even come up with the idea. Like the idea was every year in LA, there is a show called 51st Jokes that someone will run where they have a similar thing where everyone gets up and they can do one joke, which is actually, that was the first version of that show that we did in Perth. And I was just like, oh, that would be great to do in Perth. So like the idea was we're going to do this once a year January 1st or whatever the first show is, and then everyone can get up and do one joke. And then we did it that first year, and it was like the show was over like in 40 minutes or something. It was like, yeah, there's not many people, and then everyone could only do one joke and leave. And it was just so weird. It was almost more time walking up to the stage than you had on stage. And, it was a very odd, it was a very odd show. I don't think it was bad necessarily, but then it sort of evolved over time, and then it became by the end, like by the time I left, which is a year and a bit ago, I think, I was doing it like as a sort of a quarterly show, like every 3 months, everyone would come up and do up to 3 minutes, you know? But yeah, like we had a lot of really fun shows at the Flying Scotsman. It helped in a lot of ways that the management sort of didn't seem to take too much of an interest in us.
Yeah.
So we sort of got away with, like, cause we did, I don't know if you ever came to a Shroomfest show. So we did a show, we did this 2 years in a row. So Ari Shafir, like my big influence guy, he started a international holiday called Shroomfest, where on this one weekend, this designated weekend of the year, people all over the world do magic mushrooms. And the whole the idea is that you all join a collective unconscious together, and it's, you know, very airy fairy or whatever. But also mushrooms are great, and everyone should do them. So I was a big fan of this holiday, and so I decided I wanted to do a Shroomfest. I was already doing like a Shroomfest retreat that weekend,
yeah,
where we'd like get a, like it'd be like maybe me and four other comics, right? And we'd like rent an Airbnb like out in somewhere where no one knew who we were, and take a bunch of mushrooms. And it, you know, I think that's actually really a good thing for mental health, like for maintenance and introspection and so on. But then we thought, okay, let's do a Shroomfest show. Let's do a show where everyone on the lineup is actively high on magic mushrooms. And so we did this the first year, and it was weird. It was a great show, but it was very strange. They became, was that, sorry?
Did you record it?
Well, there might be. Yeah, I'm not going to ever post that. But I think, yeah, that was back when we were recording everything. But there became this sort of theme of the night that people started getting progressive, like performers started getting progressively more and more naked. And I don't know how it started. Somebody, I think, was bombing, because bear in mind, they're all high on mushrooms. Someone was bombing, and they were like, what are you, like, and they said something about, you, would you laugh if I was stripped or something? They took a shirt off, and someone else took their pants off. And by the end, like, the headliner, Sam Cribb, who's a very funny comic, he was performing in his underwear only. And so I was hosting the show, and it was, would have been weird for me to come back out fully clothed. So then I got down to my underwear, and we like had this sort of naked embrace to close out the night. It was actually a really fun show. But so we did that the first year. And then the next year I was like, well, no one from the venue had a problem with it, so I'll just do it again. And I mentioned it to someone who worked there who never passed it up the chain to management.
Mm.
And so I was promoting the show, Shroomfest or whatever. And that first one, I think it was maybe 40 like audience members. The second one, like the capacity of the venue, I think it was maybe 100, and we had like 150 people there. It just like, it spread like wildfire. Every like mushroom enthusiast in Perth, I think, heard about it somehow, and they all came to the show, and it was absolutely packed when we're upstairs at the Flying Scotsman. It was absolutely packed, and a lot of people were on mushrooms. It wasn't just the performers. And there was this guy in a top hat and with a cane and a cape, and like he was going around selling mushrooms to people at the venue. And like we told the bartender, we were like, hey, that guy's got to go. Like we're not here to promote selling mushrooms. Like that's very illegal. And I think they talked to the guy, and they were like, we don't know, whatever. But it became this really just sort of almost wildly out of control evening. Where there was a performer, I won't say his name, but he's like a punk musician, and he'd just gotten into stand-up that we'd sort of met through running shows elsewhere. And I'd put him on the lineup, and I heard like maybe, like, because all the comics had to get, by the way, this is all a joke if anyone wants to arrest me, but I had heard, like, I told all the comics, get there an hour before the show, I will give you your mushrooms. Again, this is a joke. I'll hand didn't you really your mushrooms. I want to like control your dose for like legal, like safety reasons and so on. And then, you know, you come an hour before. So this punk guy never showed up. And I was like, all right, well, I don't know. It's fine. We just want to have him on the lineup. And about 10 minutes into the show, or maybe just before the show had started, when people had already come in, somebody who knew both of us came up to me and went, hey, man, I just saw this guy on the street, like three suburbs away, like staggering through the street, and he's kicking like cones and like a construction material. And I was like, okay, well, he's not coming. You know, that's he's clearly like out of it. And then about like half an hour later, he fell up the stairs. So, because the stair, it's like a second level thing. He literally fell. He tumbled up the stairs because he was messed up. Like he was very drunk, very high. I don't know what he was on. And he was like, yeah, I'm here to do the show. And I was like, dude, I'm not giving you more drugs. Like there's no way they, there's no way I feel comfortable. Like you're clearly like already messed up. I'm not going to give you anything else. And I'm not going to have you on the show. And he started abusing me. He was like yelling at me during the break. And I'm trying to handle a Shroom Fest show and we're all sold out. And so he's yelling at me like, I like reorganized my whole night to be here. You have to put me on. And I was like, all right, I'll put you on, but I'm not giving you mushrooms. You're definitely like high enough. And he was like, fine. So then he came up, he started doing his spot. It's not going well. And then an audience member like jumps up from the crowd and then they start like sort of arguing with him. And then the audience members, like, they're on stage. And then a third guy comes up and I, like, come out and I'm, like, trying to cut the set short. And then he starts shouting at me, no, this is part of it. This is part of it. This is all part of this plan. This is plan. And I can feel the crowd being like, oh, I guess it's plan. All right, fine. And I'm like, all right, cool, cool. I walk back. And but then that argument starts to escalate and they start to, like, physically shove each other back and forth. And two different comedians come up and like, you got to stop, you got to cut this short because nothing he's saying is funny either. And so then I'm like, okay, I go up and I stop, I kick them all off the stage. And he starts messaging me very angry things like the next couple of days about how, you know, like how dare I stop what he had planned? Because apparently what he had planned was those two guys that came up were both audience plants, like friends of him. And one of them had a fake knife.
Oh my gosh.
And he had blood packs like ready to go. So he had planned at a Shroom Fest show where let's say 60% of the people in the room are high on magic mushrooms. He had planned to have a guy stab him to death. Whoa. Which means everyone like stab him to death. So then everyone would have freaked out. There would have been a stampede. Definitely the police would have called. Like by just trying to cut short like this bad 5 minutes. Like, I saved a lot of people from going to jail, it turns out. And then also, apparently, he had bought from the guy in the top hat and the cane and the cape, like, he had bought a bunch of magic mushrooms extra anyway. So, like, he fell up the stairs and then he got high on top of that. But, yeah, that was – the venue afterwards were like, hey, was, like, I think the next week, they were like, was everyone here on mushrooms last week? And I was like, yeah, of course. Like, it's the Shroom Fest show. And they went, why did you – think you could do that? And I was like, I don't know why I could do it twice, you know, like they legit like just didn't know. So yeah, we got a lot of freedom there. It was great.
Yeah, obviously. Wow. Gosh,
sorry, that's a long story.
That was a great story, but I love stories. All right, so random questions I've got for you. Has anyone ever tricked you into anything or made you believe something that just wasn't true?
I mean, a guy convinced me to blow him when I was younger.
How?
That wasn't his fault. Well, like, I think I used to do a bit about this, but I think it comes off homophobic now, so I don't do it anymore. But when I was younger, like in high school, like I think a lot of people assumed I was gay. I think because I sort of dressed preppy and I was like very well spoken or whatever, maybe a bit reserved, and those just felt like the stereotypes for that someone's gay at the time. And so enough different people sort of were like, hey, are you know, are you gay? That I started to just be like, well, I guess this many people can't be wrong. And so I just sort of started to think, well, I guess I must be. And then, yeah, like a guy put the hard word on me and I was like, well, I think I must be gay or whatever. And then I blew him up. But, yeah, I'm not. And I have no interest in it. And it was not enjoyable. But because, like, I'm a nice guy, like I finished the job I started. But as soon as we got into it, I was like, oh, I'm not interested in this at all. But I've been on the other side of that. So I was like, well, I don't want to be a dick about it. So yeah. That was a trick.
Yeah.
Let's say I tricked myself out of politeness.
You gotta, I guess, you know, experiment. So
yeah, I mean, there's nothing wrong with experimenting, but like, it was just this, I don't know what, I mean, I do know why now, but like at the time, like I immediately was like, I'm not into this at all.
Mm.
But I still like finished everything. And it's just like, man, that's a really long time between like knowing you don't want to do something and finally being like, and I won't do it again. But it's like, why do all the rest of it?
It's okay to back out, isn't it? It's okay to go, yeah, this isn't quite right.
Yeah, you can just be like, hey, I'm not into it. Like, yeah. I now know. But at the time, I felt like rude.
Yeah. But again, that's kind of kid conditioning, isn't it? Like childhood conditioning, like, yeah, I'm assuming you were young when that happened. So.
Oh, yeah, I'm not too young. I was like 18, 19 or something.
Yeah, that's young, yeah. All right, so if you could be a character in a book or a TV show, who would it be and why?
Oh, I'd like to be a successful comedian in any context. I don't know. I used to read a lot, like when I was young. I used to read all the time. And I sort of fell out of it for the last maybe 10 years, like not so much, but then during lockdown, I started reading again, like properly reading.
Mm.
And I was just rereading a book that I read when I was young, called American Gods by, Neil Gaiman. And the main character of that book is amazing. Like, he's got a bad name. His name is Shadow. But my legal name is Jez Supreme, so whatever. I love that he's just like he's got problems. He's not like a superhero kind of character, but like he's a very, let's put it like stolid and like sort of just a calm dude that just takes things as they come. And that would be cool if I wasn't like super high strung about every little thing all the time ever. Like that would be nice. So I wish I was him, even though he dies in the end, he gets manipulated by a bunch of gods and like it's a crazy thing. But it would be cool, to be like a calm person.
Mm.
Yeah, that's the character I'd like to be.
Yeah, well, it does sound pretty good, actually. What's the dumbest way you've ever been injured?
What's the what?
The dumbest way you've ever been injured.
I guess I didn't get properly injured doing this, right? I was trying to think. Yeah, I don't do this bit anymore, so I can tell you about it. I don't want to burn my material I'm still actively using. But when I was in the army, I had an incident with this guy who, like, he grew up in Poland. And, we weren't getting along. And he was sort of talking smack to me or whatever. And I said, like, he said something like, go fuck yourself. And I was like, all right, I said, like, I already did that to your mother last night, right? But it's like, that's like a pretty, you know, tame thing, especially like in the army. It's like, fine. Yeah. That's not that big a deal.
Mm.
But he stopped and he looked really serious. And he said, my mother is in a wheelchair. And I thought, I used to do this on stage, but I don't do it anymore. But I thought at the time that he was messing with me. So I went, well, that must be why she didn't move around so much. And I began to walk strut away. Cause I was like, yeah, I want that little thing. And then what happened is he jumped up behind me and he pulled out a bayonet and put a bayonet to my throat. And then like, he was about to like stab me to death. And it was like 30 soldiers like had to surround us, be like, no, don't do it. And they were just like, it's not worth it. Like no one was even just like, you know, save Jez. They were just like, dude, you don't want to go to jail, you know, like trying to talk him out of it. And I think that's the dumbest thing I've ever said that nearly, you know, got me killed.
Yeah.
Like I nearly died from like just like being a bit of a dick for no reason, you know, like, yeah, I think that's probably the worst possible consequence of a stupid thing
and
that I've done.
Jez, like true story that. So you used to be ex-military as well.
I wasn't good at it. I was a bad soldier. But yeah, I said like a few years in or whatever. But
army, I'm assuming, or
what's that, sorry?
Is it army?
Yeah. So I was in I was in the Army Reserve, and then I did like a 3-month deployment to Malaysia, and then I did some stuff where like I was sort of attached to full-time Army people for like different training and stuff. Like I never like got like properly deployed to war or anything. Mm. And I was, as I say, I was very bad at it. I was not a good soldier.
Yeah. But you tried it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I actually think I'm a much better person for having gone through it.
Mm.
Because I was poorly suited to it. Like I had to grow a lot,
yeah,
as a person. Like I definitely started learning about boundaries after a guy nearly stabbed me to death with a bayonet.
Yeah, that's pretty hardcore actually. So
yeah, I mean he overreacted too. Like definitely just, he wasn't reasonable.
Just slightly. I mean, yeah, but maybe he was good for the Army, so you know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, maybe, yeah. That was one thing that really stood out to me. Like when I went to basic training at Kapooka. Like I remember I went around at one point and I talked to like everybody in the platoon, like in our like training platoon, where I was like, you know, why did you join or whatever? I was just curious why everyone did it. And like a very high proportion of the people who joined infantry like said some variation of, yeah, I just feel like I've got anger issues. And it's like, oh man, I don't think you're supposed to have a gun. Like that's, shouldn't the psych have like weeded you out? And it's like, no, those are the people that apply. So
yeah,
it's worrying.
No, I remember once I lived in Sydney for a time and one of my friends was actually in SAS. So he got, I don't know.
They're recently in the news. Mm.
Oh, were they? Okay. I don't watch the news, yeah. So maybe I should. He's no longer with them anyway. So anyway, mm-hmm. He came to Sydney for some training thing. I was living there. He randomly rings me up. He goes, hey, I'm in Sydney. We've got some time off. I said, yeah, great. Let's catch up. I was so ignorant. I didn't realize that you're not meant to ask people if they're in SAS and, you know, it's meant to be a hush-hush thing. So I'm hanging out with some SAS guys and they're in my car and I'm like, oh, you know, so you all SAS, it's dead quiet. I'm like, oh, okay. And I, you know, I'm driving in Sydney and it was back when we had street maps. So we were lost in Sydney CBD and I'm like, okay, guys, you get the map and tell me where to go because I'm driving. And they got us more lost. And I'm like, you guys are going to be shit out in the field if you can't do the map in Australia. You know? So, they did calm down after a few drinks, you know, but they were very, very, very tight. Yeah, very tight, very, you know, rigid. So, yeah, yeah. But, no, it's, interesting breed of people sometimes in lots of different areas of work, not just Army.
Sure. Yeah, if you want to meet real sociopaths, just hang out with a bunch of comedians, you know?
I once worked for a meat marketing company as well. So, you know, going to the abattoir was always really.
Yeah, I had a friend that that worked in an abattoir and he told me like just what his normal day was like. And I was like, I could never ever handle that emotionally. No. You know, like that's just brutal. I think it just takes a certain breed of person and maybe someone who's missing part of their brain, you know, like not in a mean way, just like they just don't feel certain things. But oh man, yeah, I could never do that.
No, nor could I. It's not good. Hey, what's the best thing about you?
The best thing about me?
Oh, that's a very tough question.
Because I want to say like, oh, it's Nicole, which is like just in the game. Like my therapist would be like, that's not a good answer for that question. Yeah. I don't know. I think I'm quite smart, but I'm not as smart as I think I am. if that makes sense. But yeah, I really do like. Some of the things I come up with, sometimes I will hit some kind of creative element or whatever that I'm like, that's special. Mm. And when I make a thing like that, like I'm like, well, that's great. Like, cause no one else could have done that specific thing.
Yeah.
I suppose, yeah, creativity. I don't know. I'm like nice to people, but a lot of people don't agree with that. A lot of people think I'm a dick. But I think I'm nice to people.
Yeah, you've always been nice to me. It's all good. All right, what's one of your pet peeves then?
Pet peeves. Now, that's a lot of things.
Sorry, I've got a lot to
I, this, I mean, this is almost the flip side of what I just said, but like people who are just like mean and bullies and stuff, like it's always really disproportionately made me mad. Like not even when it's necessarily directed at me, but it's like, man, when people just like bully other people for like no reason, man, I get pissed off about it like way too much. Like I think I probably should, I have a therapy session tomorrow. Maybe I'll bring it up with him and be like, why am I getting so mad about this? But yeah, for sure. Like when people are just mean for no reason.
Yeah.
Oh man. Cause it just seems to be rife, like everywhere. I don't know.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, not just in comedy, like just in the world, you know?
Yeah.
It's, and I never could understand it. Cause I'm just like, doesn't it make you feel bad to like be mean to people? But no, for some reason it doesn't. And
You're right.
That's a very serious answer to that. But, like, I think it's it, – I guess so.
But you're right. It does cost nothing to be kind. And, you know, those little acts of kindness, it does manifest and it just makes everyone's day just so much more nicer. You know, it
might – Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah. I mean, for me, I feel like, oh, it makes you feel good to, like, do good stuff for people.
Yeah.
So why are you being a dick? Yeah. I don't get it.
No, I know. There's just some people that take, unfortunately, isn't there? Hey, are you happy to share a joke with us?
Oh, yeah, all right. Yeah, that's fine. Does it have to be my joke?
No, it can be someone else's. Just credit them.
All right, cool. Yeah, yeah, all right. I'm not going to do Eddie Murphy's ice cream bit and then be wrote that. all right, so I was thinking about this because, yeah, you said I had to do a joke. So I'm going to do a joke that I wish was mine. I wish this was mine so much. This is Glenn's joke, and I don't even think he does it anymore. So I think I'm extra okay to do it. So the joke is this. All right, so when I started watching porn, all I could find was like the hentai like anime porn, and so I started like, you know, getting really used to like that's how sex works, and so then I felt really uncomfortable the first time I had sex with actual human woman because I didn't know how to activate my tentacles. I love that joke. I think he said that like that was maybe 2 or 3 years in a comedy and we started around the same time. And I, at that moment, had in my notebook a thing about tentacles and hentai because like I, when I first started watching porn, like, because as you say, like, back in the day, it's like there was less internet, right? Like, because now it's like you got to use an actual map. Like back then, you had to use an actual map, and also like to get porn, you had to go to the video store. And so I would be like, I think I'm maybe 10 or 11 or something, like pretty young. And the only like porn I could get, because the real porn is in a separate section, would be like hentai anime stuff.
Yeah.
Because I would go and take it up to the clerk, who's like a teenager themselves, and they're like, oh, yes, this is cartoons. That makes sense. And then I go home and I watch like, you know, demon tentacle rape or whatever. And it's just like, it's so intense to start out your sexual awakening with the most fucked up thing in the world. Yeah. And so, yeah, I was trying to write a joke about that. And then he got up at an open mic and he did it. And I came to him afterwards. I was, fuck you, man. Like, you just said perfectly the joke I wanted to say, and I'll never be able to do that joke for the rest of my life. And I was so mad at him. And then when he retired it, I kept being like, no, you got to bring it back because that's my joke that I'll never get to do. Someone needs to do it. Yes.
Jez, have you recently seen, there's a thing that's gone viral. I don't watch a lot of news or TV, but it just sort of stumbled across my, I don't know, platform somehow. It's this lady who eats all these different weird food things, right? And she tries to eat a live octopus. Have you seen that one?
I haven't, although, yeah. Like, man, even eating, because I ate some dead octopus and I was like, this is not okay to eat because it's so much cartilage. It tastes like eating through an ear.
Yeah.
Like, I can't imagine eating a live one on top of that. Like,
this thing wriggling. It attaches itself to her face and she's having to rip it off and it actually bites her. So I'm like, you know,
wow. Well, I mean, yeah, wouldn't you? Like, it's very reasonable of the octopus.
Yeah, yeah. So it's actually going viral at the moment. So I'm sure you'll come across it if you haven't seen it.
I'll send it to Glenn.
Yeah. Yeah, there'll be a reference there, won't there? Hey, Jez, how can people find you on social media?
I think my handle on all the social platforms is at Infinite Jez, because I used to run Infinite Jest. But you go to my website, jezwatts.com. Yep. I'm in the middle of making a a YouTube bunny rabbit comedy musical that's like a choose your own adventure comedy musical. It's a very odd concept, but there's some of that stuff up on my YouTube, which you can find through our website and stuff.
We'll
jesswatts.com.
Thanks, Jess. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks for everyone for listening in. So you're listening to Yvonne Fletcher from NY Events, and we've got multiple comedies running at the moment at the Charles Hotel, Kalamunda Hotel, Guildford Sterling Arms, Parkerville and the Corrine. Hope to see you guys soon. Check us out on social media as well at NY Events. And thanks, Jez. It's been a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you, Yvonne.
All right, take care.
Bye.